We've been talking about Asperger syndrome, a developmental disorder that was only recently recognized. My guest, Michael John Carley, was diagnosed with Asperger's 4 years ago when he was in his mid-30s. It helped explain a lot about his life. Now he heads an education and support group for people with Asperger's called GRASP. He's worked as the UN representative of the group Veterans for Peace and directed the group's Iraq Water Project. He's also written several plays and is a part-time overnight classical music announcer on the public radio station WNYC in New York. Michael, how were you first diagnosed with Asperger syndrome?
Well, my son, when he was 2 years old, started to exhibit a lot of the usual telltale signs, language issues. There were some motor skills issues. And so my wife at the time and I, you know, started him on that battery of tests and process towards the diagnosis, which includes hearing tests, IT, it includes speech therapy, play therapy. And 2 years later, he was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, and exactly 1 week later, I was diagnosed with it. And the reason for this is really just that once they start to key in on the kids, it's a genetic thing. I think most everybody agrees. And so inevitably, you know, the clinicians that are responsible for this diagnosis are starting to look at dad out of the corner of their eyes. And so one thing leads to another.
Were you surprised to be diagnosed yourself?
Initially, when the idea first came forth, yes. The whole suggestion of it just seemed, you know, too ridiculous. You know, we regard this as a form of autism. And here I was, somebody that had done things, had lived a life, etc. But I also had known that I'd always suspected that, you know, I really didn't have that sense of shared experience with other people that I had wanted and yearned for in my life. And the more I started to look into it, the more it made absolute sense in a real epiphanal, you know, sort of way. I mean, really hitting you like a ton of bricks. And so by the time that the official diagnosis came about, it was really etched in stone that this was obviously what had been going on my entire life.
What were some of the things that the diagnosis helped explain to you about yourself?
Well, really just, you know, it's the whole notion of personality comes in later. I think first off, what you go through when you get a diagnosis so late in life is that you have to reexamine so many incidents in your history. You know, you have to reevaluate and look at everything and say, so that's why people thought that I was being a jerk. And that's why people thought that I was being a tell it like it is guy. You know, you're always surrounded by this negative and this positive iconography. But you also know now they were all wrong, both the positives and the negatives. Nobody had you pegged right.
What was most confusing to you about, quote, normal behavior and quote, normal conversations and social skills?
Small talk, especially. I never was very good at small talk. I never understood it. I never understood that when people would ask me about something that I was interested in and I would, you know, completely go off because I was, you know, so in love with this particular, you know, study or item or something like that. And then people would roll their eyes and I would feel, that's not fair. You asked me what I felt about this. Why are you rolling your eyes sarcastically? Pettiness, I think, is something that is very anathema to all of the people in our community. It's just something that we don't understand, and that in the support groups that my organization runs, we really try to point out to individuals on the spectrum what pettiness is, because really when you deconstruct it, it's something that we instinctively do not understand. And it's something that we need to understand, because not only is it something that, you know, is a stumbling block for us, but it's an unfriendly creature. And we need to know how to navigate around it and not to take it too personally.
Now, you've written plays, some of which have been produced. Writing plays seems to go against some of the typical Asperger syndrome symptoms, as I understand them, lacking in empathy, talking obsessively about your passion but not being very interested in what others have to say, not understanding the pleasures of conversation, not comprehending humor. When you're a playwright, you're writing conversation. Hopefully there's some humor in it, and hopefully you have empathy with your characters. So how do those square?
That's an excellent question. And there's an answer for it. And that is that really one thing that is enormously helpful to all individuals on the spectrum. We see about, you know, we have about 400 people in the Manhattan support group. I'm actually not digressing, trust me. And so many of them that have had more success in being able to process what other people's feelings are have had a theater background. They may not have succeeded in that theater background, but it's a real leitmotif. I think especially the actor training that anybody has to go through to learning how to be in somebody else's shoes. And there's another side to the theater training that's another dodged bullet, even though at the time I didn't know I was dodging bullets. And that's the physical training that you go through, because a lot of us have motor skills issues. And I had real issues with my hands and controlling my hands. And the physical discipline that you have to, you know, accrue as an actor really, really helps to compensate for some of those motor skills issues. Even if, you know, the actor next to you is doing 10 times better with his hand control than you are, and you're getting mad about it at the time.
But if you don't really like small talk and conversation, and empathy isn't your thing, why would you gravitate to writing plays in the first place?
Well, I think no matter what, you know, I always grew up with, as, you know, somebody who, you know, selfishly perhaps, you know, felt that, you know, I had something to say. But the empathy quotient, I think, is more best answered by seeing my plays. They're really ideas, and they're arguments of ideas that get thrown around. You know, I was never a good student of philosophy. I would just, you know, pick up a philosophy book and, you know, read a sentence or two and be able to, you know, just grab just one idea, and then really be able to put, you know, some dramatized discourse of it down on paper. And I think that in my plays, what I would do to compensate for the Aspergian sense, I could pick up and give, you know, class distinctions or economic distinctions or racial distinctions and the dialogue and the vernacular that people hear, because I had a very good ear. But I think when it comes time to really people speaking from inside their souls, you know, that I actually just didn't do that. I actually just put certain ideas and certain arguments into certain characters and very mathematically matched them up with that particular economic or racial, characteristic, and just let the math do its work.
Now, you worked with the group Veterans for Peace. Are you a veteran?
No, I am not. I was, as a matter of fact, one of the few non-veterans that worked with the group. My loophole into them was that my father was killed in Vietnam, and this actually has some of the reason why so much of my, you know, shall we say, Aspergian tendencies growing up were so misinterpreted. Because, you know, I grew up amidst the iconography of the Vietnam War. I had people from the left telling me my father was a murderer. I had people from the right telling me things about patriotism and God, which, you know, I just didn't really get and didn't really understand and didn't really believe in, you know, although I respected their beliefs. And so inevitably, I really had to, I think, and this is hard to say, but really tune off those adults in my life. But at the same point, acknowledge that all of my behavioral differences when I was going to the school I was going to up until ninth grade, which was not a good institution for me to be at, that they were being interpreted as some sort of rebellion because of my having lost my father in the Vietnam War. And it was a very easy answer. As a matter of fact, I was going through, you know, huge school difficulties in third grade, and the school finally said to my mother, look, you have to get this kid a psychological evaluation. And I have that psychological evaluation, and I use it in some of the speeches that I give at conferences, because it's very fascinating in the sense that when they document my behaviors and when they look at exactly some of the things that I'm doing in their tests, they're actually quite accurate. And, you know, anybody looking at this today would say, Asperger's, easy.
My guest is Michael John Carley. He heads an education and support group for people with Asperger syndrome called GRASP. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael John Carley. He and his son were diagnosed with the developmental disorder Asperger syndrome 4 years ago. What are some of the ways that you think Asperger syndrome may have interfered, if at all, with relationships, with intimate relationships in your life?
Well, it always made me bad at flirting, and it always meant that, you know, I was never going to be a good dancer or anything like that. You know, one of the things we tell all the folks that we have, you know, is avoid the bars. Please avoid the bars. Please don't try and pretend to be like the people who wink in beer commercials. Please don't do that. You'll fall on your face. There's an inevitable banana peel somewhere in your crystal ball. But I think that, you know, one of the things that doesn't really get talked about sometimes is that there are actually some attributes that don't get developed enough, such as, you know, we're known for being an inordinately honest people. You know, sometimes obviously to a fault, we say what comes into our heads, and sometimes it's very inappropriate. But this can be compensated by education. And for the most part, a lot of the relationships that I did have were based on people looking at me, seeing, you know, a certain amount of, you know, passion that I was putting into whatever work that I was putting into, you know, admiring me because of that and not because I wore the right clothes. And, you know, in conversing with me, realizing that I wasn't going to be somebody who could, quote unquote, play the game. And that's attractive to a lot of people. And it unfortunately doesn't get developed enough in the adults that we have.
Now, your son has Asperger's syndrome. Did you recognize any similarities, or do you recognize any similarities between his behavior and yours?
A plethora. He's a twin in so many ways, behaviorally and in the way in which he's processing thought, processing experience. And it's a joy to raise him because I know that, you know, there's a good and a bad to being diagnosed late. And the bad is obviously that you would have known yourself a lot better early on, I think. But the good is that you avoided so much negative iconography. You know, people weren't prepared to deal with this. And if anybody had used, you know, Asperger's syndrome or autism as a word to describe me way back then in the early 70s when I'm, you know, Will's age, then, you know, suddenly that would be a horrific future for me, just because of the times we lived in. What my son is going through right now is vastly different. He's accepted for those behavioral differences. People know what's going on with him.
Do you think that there are certain things that parents typically want from their children, or like emotions they want their children to give back, that children with Asperger's syndrome are unable or less likely to do?
Yes. The best example comes from Tony Atwood's book, where there was a mother who was finally had to break down crying to her 8-year-old child. Why do you never, ever tell me that you love me? Why? And the child just looked at her perplexed and said, "Mom, I told you that when I was 6.
Mm-hmm. So as we've established the fact, there's no point to reiterate it.
No, exactly. Well, the child with Asperger's syndrome is like, well, but I already told you that. Why do you need to hear it again? The whole notion of the need for affirmative reinforcement is something that is not instinctive to us. We don't understand it. We can learn it very easily. But at that age, I can purely, you know, see that child's point of view.
Well, Michael Giancarlo, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It has been my pleasure.
Michael Giancarlo is the executive director of GRASP, an education and support group for people with Asperger's syndrome.